Members, today we're going to take up a bill that the House passed. Representative Lincheski authored it in the House. I authored it in the Senate. It's House File 392. It looks significantly different than what originally was introduced. So what we have, so we get it in the shape that we want it in, is there is the A1 amendment. And the A1 amendment, members, it puts the bill back in the shape that it originally was introduced in. So it's the Senate language. As the bill was brought to us, had been signed off on by the governor's office. It was the department's original provisions of the conformity that was then later amended by the House. So to get the bill back into the shape that it is here in the Senate, we need to, maybe we'll start some testimony on it. We don't quite have a quorum yet to adopt the amendment, but on the A1 amendment, Ms. Cadoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Revenue. I want to thank you for hearing House File 392 today, which is a bill dealing with federal conformity. The bill that's now, as amended, as the Chair mentioned, was the bill as we originally recommended from the Department of Revenue and has been agreed upon with the Governor's Office as part of the Governor's budget recommendation for federal conformity. We had really looked at federal conformity as being a two-bill, excuse me, a two-part process. With part one, the bill now in front of you would be a much more small federal conformity, with the idea that we would be adopting much more comprehensive federal conformity as part of the omnibus tax bill. How we originally structured it was with the idea that we really needed to minimize any fiscal impact to fiscal year 09, which is why we first put forth this much more modest proposal. What the amendment now does in front of you, I can maybe just have Mark Peterson step through, if you'd like to go through the details of the bill at this point.
Sure. And members, the fiscal note on the bill is the one that's, there's two of them in your packet. One is dated February 13th. That's actually off of the House file. The one you want that we're going to work off is the January 29. Fiscal note, and so you'll see the general fund impact. It raises about $90,000 in 09, $65,000 in 10, $75,000 in 11. So the bill actually raises a small amount of money, so there's no cost to it. Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. I'll just go through what this bill is going to be, this amendment will be doing. Since we last did a federal update last February, Congress has passed four major bills, a couple other minor bills that made amendments to the Internal Revenue Code. And what this does is that it picks up all the changes of the first bill, which is one that was primarily related to helping members of the military. It was mainly a non-tax bill, but there were some tax provisions in there. And then pick up a few provisions that affect a lot of individuals mainly from the other bills. In particular, the HEROES Assistance did one significant thing in that it allows members of the military who have tax-exempt combat pay to be able to elect to use that combat pay when calculating their federal work earned income credit, which would carry over to their state earned income credit. Made some other minor changes on their ability to make contributions into IRA and take money out of a flexible spending account. And another thing it did to pay for this was created a new tax regime on persons who are giving up their United States citizenship who have net worth of over $2 million and have over $600,000 of unrealized capital gains. For purposes of this, they'll be deemed to have sold all of their property on the day that they expatriate. Becomes effective June 17th of last year. provisions from the Housing Assistance Act, which was the third of the bills, it created an additional standard deduction for property taxes payable for non-business property, which was equal to the lesser of the taxes paid, or $500, $1,000 per individual married couple. That provision we pick up, but then we also then have an addition for it later on. An exemption from tax for interest paid from certain state or local bonds guaranteed by the Federal Home Loan Bank. So for those bonds issued by the state of Minnesota or a subdivision, they'll be exempt from Minnesota tax if we pick this up. And then there's also an exclusion from the alternative minimum tax for certain bonds issued by state and local governments for first-time home buyers, moderate income housing, and owner-occupied housing for veterans. Then in the emergency bill that was passed in October, that standard deduction for property taxes was extended for one additional year, and then two other provisions were extended: the $250 adjustment in the computation of federal adjusted gross income for teacher K through 12 teacher expenses, and the $4,000 higher education tuition expense. And both of those we pick up, but then we will have add-backs for them later on. One other provision that's really being picked up here, in the HEROES bill, there was a change in the definition of wages for withholding purposes, and that would now include differential pay, which is the pay that some employers pay to their employees when they're called to active duty, make up the difference between the civilian pay and their military pay. That provision for withholding purposes effective January 1 of 2008 federally, we're picking that provision up at the same time, but realizing we can't really do a retroactive withholding requirement, there's a provision in here that says we won't penalize or assess tax against an employer who failed to withhold Minnesota tax on that differential pay. That's the bulk of the bill.
Senator Skoy moves. We have a quorum of all members. Senator Skoy moves the A1 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Ms. Cadoon, any other testimony?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I did want to mention, as I said before, that we really we appreciate doing this Part 1 version of federal conformity, but we'd really strongly encourage, as part of the omnibus tax bill, that hopefully you can look at a more comprehensive federal conformity. If I advocate for that for just a minute. As you know, Minnesota's individual income tax and corporate franchise tax is obviously closely linked with federal definitions. And the more we deviate from those definitions, really the more complex and cumbersome the compliance with our tax laws become. It's really a nuts and bolts issue, federal conformity is, for making sure taxpayers can comply with our tax laws. I noticed, and it also helps achieve really a key tax policy principle of making sure we have an understandable tax system. I noticed in a handout that Senator Pogemiller gave to your committee a couple weeks ago dealing with the draft goals of the Senate Tax Committee. One of those objectives is that the tax system should promote a clear, visible, and understandable tax structure that minimizes the cost of administration and compliance, which is exactly why we strongly advocate federal conformity and doing as much, I guess, as fiscally that the state is able to at this point. What I'd also just like to say is for the just highlight a few items that we would not be adopting today, because obviously these do impact the current tax filing season. They impacted 2008 calendar year, which is obviously the tax filing season that people are currently filing. We'll receive the bulk of our 2.6 million, obviously, individual income tax filings. We've so far received basically 1 million filings. We'll now receive the others between now and mid-April. If you do adopt a more comprehensive package in May as part of the omnibus tax bill for these, a lot of these individuals impacted, they're probably holding off filing at this point because we have alerted folks, individuals, that it's possible that the legislature would adopt some of these changes as has been typically done in the past. So a lot of these individuals are frankly probably holding off filing. If you do adopt it later, they probably just have to do amended returns. But for many of these provisions, it also impacts the business and corporate filers. Most of those don't file until October, So if you do adopt it later, obviously that would help greatly relieve the administrative complexity and burdens. Just highlight a couple items that would be not in this bill but are part of the congressional changes that occurred in 2008 that we'd not be adopting at this point and hopefully can look to adopt later. One would allow direct transfers from IRAs to charities by taxpayers that are 70 and a half and older without triggering taxable liability. If we do not adopt this, obviously that creates a lot of complexity for taxpayers that are impacted by those provisions. They would have to recalculate their taxable income, potentially have more of their Social Security income would become taxable. And obviously for those, it's a fairly small dollar amount, but for those individual income tax filers, it could have a great complexity as well as additional tax burden that they might be not expecting. Congress also passed, as part of the earlier economic stimulus bill, many provisions dealing with business expensing and depreciation. These provisions, we hope, can be picked up later. There really is, and maybe Mark Peterson just mentioned some of the complexities if we never do pick up these provisions, because it does have some long-term administrative complexities. So I don't know if Mark could just mention an example or two of what impact is of that.
Sure. When we're looking at it, there's a lot of expensing rather than depreciating, a lot of expensing rather than making adjustments to basis. And most of these changes are to really targeted industries, and it'd be really hard to come up with, you know, identifying who these taxpayers are, being able to write instructions for them, and the separate record keeping that they'd have to do. It'd be really hard for the businesses and for the department to audit. And we're looking at things like expensing for farmers of endangered species preservation activities, farmers buying property, Indian reservation property, and that wouldn't really be purchases by Indian tribes. It's non-Indians purchasing things on Indian reservations and for used in business for depreciation schedules being cut from 39 years to 25 years and from 15 years to 7 years. Recycling property used in recycling, changes in depreciation schedules, leasehold improvements to restaurants, to retail, going from 39 years to 15. If we don't pick it up, we've got adjustment there for 39 years for the businesses and for the department to keep track of. Environmental remediation expenses at the brownfield sites, REITs, real estate investment trusts. There were some really subtle changes to real estate investment trusts that could potentially mean that we would have some taxable REITs at the state level that would not be taxable at the federal level. So that would have to be undone by both the by the entity level and by the individuals who would report that income. Film and TV production expensing rather than amortizing, depreciating. These are not mainly things that would just affect 1 year. They would affect the computation for 5, 10, maybe, in many instances, 39 years.
Mr. Chair, just one final comment. On the most recent federal economic stimulus bill that was passed, we are currently looking at the revenue impacts of those provisions, and hopefully we can have a discussion later in the year of our recommendations regarding that federal conformity bill.
Well, Ms. Cadoon, I just want to be clear. There will be additional federal conformity provisions passed by this committee or passed by the full Senate. So nobody should think that this is the end of federal conformity for the session.
It's good to hear, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking at the fiscal note for the A1 amendment. It looks fairly minimal. Do we know, do these other items have more fiscal implications?
They do. The House budget bill has some additional conformity in it, and what they do to pay for it is they delay about $15 million of corporate tax refunds that would be due in this biennium. I was a little uncomfortable doing that, so I'm not suggesting that we do that. Need to have a conversation with the corporate community to see how they feel about the idea of delaying refunds out into the next biennium. I suspect the House isn't probably not going to take our approach. They feel pretty strongly about doing additional conformity. So we'll get an opportunity to have that discussion, I think, in conference.
The House, we have the House fiscal note.
Right.
$90,000-ish to over $12 million. That's the difference.
Right.
Okay.
Jeanette Blankmanship.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tanya Orr from the Housing Finance Agency, and I'm here today to just talk really briefly about Section 10 and urge passage of that. The Housing Finance Agency is one of the largest issuers of tax-exempt bonds in the state. Last year, we served about 2,700 first-time home buyers with median incomes of about $40,000. In July, Congress made housing bonds exempt from the alternative minimum tax. The effect of this is to increase the pool of investors who would be interested in buying our bonds. It also impacts the interest rate at which the bonds are sold. And that impacts the interest rate at which the mortgages for the first-time homebuyers that we're trying to help. We had a bond sale that closed early in February. And at the post-sale analysis report to the board last week, our financial advisor indicated that we paid probably a 5 to 10 basis point penalty because the Minnesota had not conformed to the federal law. We hope to be back in the market again. As you know, the municipal bond market has been very challenging in the last number of months. But the president and Secretary Geithner have pledged that they will take actions to support the state housing finance agencies in assisting homeowners. So we are very hopeful that we'll be back in the market. And if we are, then we don't want to be in a position again to have to pay a penalty, which would be passed on to home buyers, or to have to time the bond sale around the action, waiting for action by the legislature. So we would really urge quick resolution of this. And we'd like to reiterate Ms. Kadun's comments about larger federal conformance. In the economic stimulus package, there are provisions about AMT relief and refunding of bonds. We will be doing some of that this late spring, and so we hope again that Minnesota can conform so we won't have to pay the additional penalty. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Orr. Any questions of Ms. Orr? Thank you. Frank Fallon. Is it? No? Okay. We'll take him off. Members, any other discussion on the A1? It's been adopted before we move to other amendments. Senator Skoy.
No, I'll wait till. Is the A1 been adopted?
The A1's been adopted.
Mr. Chair, I have the A2 amendment, and I'd like to move that. And if I could then go into some discussion about what the A2 amendment is when it's passed, being passed out.
Senator Skoy, on the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, if you would allow me just a couple minutes to talk a little bit about how we got to the A2 amendment. For the last couple, 3 years, we've been having some ongoing discussions with regard to the preferential tax treatment that Green Acres has been receiving. We've had the department give us an update and a report for the last 2 years, and we also had the legislative auditor's report, which brought to light a number of programs with the Green Acres program that was in place. Those problems were ununiform implementation. We had 30-some counties that weren't implementing at all. There were problems with the definition of agriculture. There were problems with the income requirements. A whole host of issues, and the department, while it, or the legislative auditor, while it said that the Green Acres program was fairly effective at equalizing taxes on ag land, it wasn't doing, it didn't have much in it in the way of long-term sustainability for these lands. And so we made some changes last year trying to address the problem of this tax shift that was going on. And if you recall back to the dollars that were being shifted, there was almost $40 million worth of taxes being shifted from one landowner onto another across the state. We had some counties in the state that were having homeowners with almost a 20% property tax increase to pay for this shift. And so last year we made some changes to the Green Acres program. There were a number of issues that arise out of those changes, and this is an effort to fix some of those problems that came about as a result of the changes we did last year. I've been through a couple of committees with the Green Acres bill. I listened to a lot of people and think that we are reaching some common ground on where we ought to be going with this. So with that, if I could just kind of walk through the principles of what we are doing here, and then if we need to, I can go through the specific bill. But what I'm proposing with the A2 amendment is to take the Green Acres program as it was in place for 40 years and kind of go back to what its original intent was to equalize taxes on ag land. And so what I'm proposing is to go back to the three-year clawback for that program, have these lands be parcels that are conforming to the classification of agriculture, and really kind of reinstall the Green Acres program as it was prior to this, allowing transfer of lands to children, not having reapplication if there was marriage, death, or divorce, and then removing the grandfather provision that came into our discussion last year in the conference committee. And so the Green Acres program in and of itself would be primarily a program that would be in place to equalize taxes on land that's in conformity with the ag classification, which is the 2A classification. Now, that leaves the problem that has arisen over these changes that we proposed from last year. There's a large number of parcels that are currently enrolled in the Green Acres program. And what do we do with those programs? And we had a lot of discussion about the importance to the state of maintaining these open spaces and these conservation lands, and so what I'm proposing is that we develop another separate program for these lands. And the reason that I'm proposing a separate program is if we do not move these non-conforming parcels out of the Green Acres program, we continue to have the problem of finding a uniform state value for these parcels, because they're very different as you look across the state. Obviously, these type of lands that are in close to the metropolitan area would have a significantly higher value than parcels out in the northwest part of the state. It was almost impossible to come up with a uniform valuation mechanism. So we're proposing to move these parcels into a conservation program. We would give them 4 years of the same tax treatment that they're currently receiving. And then after this four-year time period, we would ask that these parcels do two things. First is that they would develop a conservation plan. And there's a number of organizations around the state that would be able to do this. We list them in the bill. The one that comes to mind most in my discussions with Mr. Knopf is the Soil Water Conservation Districts. They currently are doing this. They have the capability to do it. The plan is not so cumbersome that it would be hard to do. It is mostly a legal description, an aerial photo, a description of soil type, a description of what the land use is, and proposal for future conditions for the land. So then after the plan has been drawn up and the 4 years has gone by, these landowners, in order to continue to receive the preferential tax treatment, would be required to put a covenant on their parcel. I've modeled the covenant on the current Sustainable Forestry Initiative. It's an 8-year covenant. We did make a couple of subtle changes to the covenant in that once an individual would apply, they would have to wait 4 years to make an application for withdrawal. After that application is in place, they would have to wait another 4 years in order to withdraw from the program. After they withdraw from the program, they would have to wait another 3 years in order to reapply. And there's the reason behind that is one of the things that occurs with the Sustainable Forestry Initiative Covenant is people will come in on Wednesday and sign up for it, and then they'll come in on Thursday and sign up to withdraw from it. And so we're trying to make some subtle changes here that would help us in that regard. The valuation of these lands. When you look at what's going on across the state with regard to these parcels of land, the discussion is that there are a lot of values outside of the 2A classification that's driving up the value, whether it's commercial, industrial, seasonal, recreational, or residential. And so what the policy is that these parcels of land should be valued comparable to what the agriculture land in their area would be. And if you see in here on page 5, line 12 through 20, we talk about the determination of value on these conservation property lands. And if you get down toward the end of it, actually it's 19 and 20, the assessor shall not consider the presence of commercial, industrial, residential, or seasonal recreational land use influences that may affect the value. So we think we've got a pretty good mechanism in place for determining the value. And but just to ensure that we're doing what we think we are going to do here, if you turn to page 12 at the very end, section 6, we are asking the Commissioner of Revenue to study and annually report to the chairs on the committee on taxes a number of things: trends in market value of 2A and 2B, green acres value methodology and determinations, and assessment and classification practices. Particularly interested in some of the assessment and classification practices to make sure that we have uniformity across the state. But also, I think it's going to be interesting to look at what these value methodologies are, and maybe they shouldn't remain exactly the same over a 40-year time period. Maybe they should be kind of something that gets adjusted on an ongoing basis. So we have that provision in there. So I think I have covered most of the large parts of this bill in my discussion. I think that this solution will meet the needs of the folks that are involved in this. I think it will equalize taxes well on ag lands. I think it allows a mechanism to be in place to retain this open space and other land that has been determined to be valuable, and will provide those lands ongoing benefit for their preferential tax treatment that they're receiving. And I certainly would stand for questions, but if I could turn to Ms. Soff, who I've been working with on this, and see if there's something that she thinks I've left out of my discussion that I should bring forward.
Mr. Chair, Senator Savoy, I think the provisions in the grandfather in Section 2 were changed quite a bit. I don't know. You provided that if there was a transfer to the center daughter, the owner, that would continue to remain in the program. And if the property is enrolled in the conservation program, there's no recapture. But you did limit the general grandfather to the purchase.
Thank you, Ms. Soff. Yes, that is something that I should have mentioned, is that Lands that are currently enrolled in a conservation program, CRP and RIM, et cetera, would be eligible to be in the Green Acres program. I think that there would at some point be an opportunity for a landowner to decide which program they would like to be in if they're applying, because in my view these lands could technically be qualified for both programs if they have a conservation plan and are willing to put a covenant on. And then we did make a change in the grandfather provision. We did remove most of it, but we do make it that there will be no changes until the 2013 assessment. And then on page 3, land that can be transferred to a son or daughter, and that would remain the same as what landowners had in place when they signed up, that marriage, death, divorce, and transfer to a son or daughter would not require re-eligibility to Green Acres.
Jim?
Members, on line 1.7, first page, where it says Article 1, that should say Article 2. So Senator Skoy moves an oral amendment on line 1.7 after the word article, delete 1 and insert 2. Everybody understand that? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion. The oral amendment is adopted. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Skoy, I appreciate the work here. I think it's really excellent, and particularly the schedule of applying and withdrawing that takes away some of the gaming that was done with it. But I wonder specifically with the abuses that were reported in the legislative auditor's report, are there that we handled with a sledgehammer last year, obviously much to our regret, but are there any abuses in this proposal that go unanswered that you recall? Are there still some slippery spots that we just don't have a handle on, or are we just going to have to wait and see?
Mr. Chair and Senator Est, I think with regard to the land that is conforming to the ag classification, we'll be fine. We have had a fair amount of discussion about some assessors were trying to do separate values on relatively insignificant parcels of a Green Acre program somebody who's in the Green Acres program currently. And what was happening is we put it language into the bill last year that said if land was impracticable to separate the value separately, that it would all qualify for Green Acres. Well, people were saying, well, we have GPS now, and we can put a separate value on every little thing that is out there, whether it's a rock pile, a ravine, or anything. And that caused a lot of problems. And so we have strengthened the language there so that the assessor must not include those parcels or remove those parcels from Green Valley, Green Acres. And we included the language that they must be impracticable to value separately and could not be sold separately. And we think that that'll get at a lot of that kind of incidental initiatives. The other issue that we really heard a lot about was the CRP and the RIM, and we addressed that. We heard a lot about transferring family farms from parents to child. We have addressed that. And we heard a lot about the 7-year clawback that came in conference committee. We have addressed that. One other thing that we did do is because if some parcels, and I think under this new proposal, these will be relatively small and only parcels that are under 10 acres, actually, which really should have never been in before because they weren't large enough to meet the criteria. But if somebody does have a parcel that is removed from this preferential tax treatment, they would get a 1-year period where they could leave the program with no clawback at all. And that's because we made changes to the law that was outside of their ability to impact. And we did this retroactive back to the change that we made last year. So if somebody, and I don't think this is out there, but it might be, somebody did actually withdraw from the program between April of last year or May of last year and the time that this becomes enacted in the law, they also would not be subject to that clawback and would get their money back.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, with this new conservation plan, conservation management plan approach, how do you expect people to act differently than they have in the past with this new approach that separates it from Green Acres? What would who's going to do this, and what were they doing before? And I don't mean before last year's law. I mean, what were they doing before the law was changed last year that they will do differently with your approach?
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest. Well, really, the landowner was not required to do much of anything prior to the changes we did last year with regard to his land for the preferential tax treatment. Mm-hmm. There was some small income criteria. They had to be larger than 10 acres and have some egg production on it. So it was pretty minimal, and there was very little going on to ensure that there was some benefit.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sorey, this is a very proactive approach to these conservation lands.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Ress, what they're going to be doing now is developing a conservation plan. So somebody will be thinking about what the benefits will be received to the environment from the tax, for the preferential tax break they're getting. Mm-hmm. And they also will have a covenant as opposed to the clawback. So that is different. The other thing, the valuation mechanism is, I think, solid in policy, because the discussion has always been that we have had these pressures outside of agriculture driving up the land values and making them subject to development or whatever. And people didn't want that to happen, so they're going to give the thing. So what we've done is we've taken all of those mechanisms out of the valuation, and we're just applying the ag value to it. Now, obviously, there might be some shifting going on, and we're going to have the department look at that and report back to us, and we've got 4 years to kind of figure out exactly where that goes. But I think the policy on that is very solid.
Mr. Chairman, one
more
question. There have been proposals over the past for similar treatment to lakeshore land, so-called Blue Acres treatment. How does this proposal affect, if at all, I just want to be clear, any lakeshore land that some would like to, well, depending on your point of view, either shelter from having any neighbors or make sure it's used for conservation and et cetera, all those nice goals.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rest, I'm not going to pull the exact page out, but what we're doing here is there will be parcels of land that, as this goes forward, that weren't in Green Acres that will be applying and enrolling in this conservation plan. They could conceivably be on a body of water.
Okay.
As long as they are meeting the criteria, they could conceivably apply and qualify for this program. But they would have to be currently in the 2B, the A classification, 2B classification, I believe it is.
So it doesn't, Mr. Chairman, it doesn't specifically bar them, although it's unlikely.
Well, I think the issue, Senator Rest, is
unlikely.
They can't be in the seasonal rec classification now and qualify. They need to be classified as ag land. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Scoy, I really appreciate the Green Acres being reinstated back to kind of, I appreciate that work. But you said yourself, both this type of land could be in either program. I highly object to any more authority given to the watershed districts. They were established in the mid-90s. I don't think they've even in their own group delineated exactly what their authorities are. I think that there's been some hostility with landowners at this particular point until they have their entire program running what I consider more smoothly, would I give them more oversight? I think keeping everything under Green Acres and maybe making a larger, broader definition there might be helpful, but giving any more authority watershed districts or soil conservation districts, I find highly objectionable.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think we're giving any authority, certainly not to watershed districts, because they're not part of this. We are asking for qualified people to draw up these conservation plans. And if you look on page 4, line 22, we're asking that natural resource professionals, they can be self-employed, private companies, individuals, nonprofit organizations, local units of government or public agencies that are approved by the Board of Water Soil Resources. The reason that I mentioned soil water conservation districts, and I'm probably not as familiar with the ones in your areas and my area, but they currently are doing this. And we didn't want them to be, you know, just inundated with these plans. So that's part of the reason that we're giving, a 4-year time period for all of this to be implemented so that we have an opportunity to do a good job with that. But I don't think we're giving any more authority to any of those organizations. We're just asking them if they choose to register with the board to draw up conservation plans.
Senator Sway, they're only one of the people that could write a
plan.
They're just allowing them to be able to write a plan to meet the criteria. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right now, do we have a definition of conservation land now? Is that a definition that we use, or is this a new definition that's new to statute?
There's no specific definition of conservation land, but this section 4 sets out the requirements of the types of land that can qualify for the use.
All right. Mr. Chair, the reason I brought it up, I had a real estate transaction last year where a county had created what they called their big plan or their 20-year plan. It really wasn't formal, but there was a map that was created by the county, and they went around all of the natural resource features of that county, and they took all of the adjoining property, let's say around a marsh or a swamp, and they colored it in, and they called it their conservation designated district. And although they didn't make any changes on zoning, the farmer who owned it could not change his zoning at all, except for he had to maintain it in agricultural purposes, which for that county only restricted it to one home or homestead per every 60 acres. That considerably changed the value opportunity for the farmer to sell that for any other purpose. But because there was a map, a 20-year vision of what the county had, they weren't going to change their map, although they hadn't zoned it any other way except agricultural. And, of course, myself representing the landowner, I wanted to know what options the property owner had to elevate the value of the land for specific purpose. Essentially, it was a unofficial rezoning of the farmland, but without a zoning certificate. They did say at one time in a classified ad as public notice that the owner, if he had any questions, could come to the county board meeting and review it. That was 8 years before yes, last year's date. And the homeowner, or the property owner, no longer lived in that county. They were renting the land out, and they lived in Robbinsdale. And this county was in Wright County. So it essentially was a rezoning of the property without a zoning method or alteration to the zoning classification. And I was, the word conservation came up on your language here, and I was just wondering if we're confusing it, or there may be confusion because there's no other definition, and a county somewhere used that same word to use it to perhaps hold some property in abeyance until for some future environmental protection opportunity. And I suppose the counties will have to catch word of this and change their language, but it raises another field of questions when it comes to public notice and zoning, and what are we doing as local subdivisions in what essentially turns into a taking,
and Mr.
because
Chair,
it limits the value.
Conversely, how could this language be?
Senator Dibble.
Oh, thanks. I was just going to respond to Senator Limmer, who just did you notice his bad pun there, by the way? Field of questions for ag land. I actually, yeah, there's things. You're the one who did it. I actually interpret this situation as the opposite of what we see in, yeah, in the bill. You know, that's an external activity that seeks to depress the potential value. What Senator Scoy recognizes in his bill is there is land that's either an ag, the Green Acres tool, or now this tool that's not being used explicitly for ag, but is being reserved for conservation purposes, you know, for good reasons, that has a pressure external to it to increase the value, and they're trying to hold that pressure in abeyance and serve a larger public good. You know, there's pressure on these sorts of lands for development, of course. That's what we most quickly think of in a lot of areas, particularly closer into the metro, but in lots of areas. There's also a lot of pressure to drive up the value of this land for recreational purposes, hunting purposes, those sorts of things. So I understand your point. We need to be precise and think clearly about what we're trying to accomplish, but I think we're talking about actually the 180, the mirror image of what the circumstance here is that we're trying to address.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And conversely to what Senator Limmer was saying, what if the definition is used incorrectly or used in a manner other than intended? Because I truly can see some soil and water conservation districts using this language to their intentions.
Mr. Scott?
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the landowner would have to go to the plan drafter and ask them to draw a plan. I don't see how the Soil Water Conservation District could get involved unless the landowner came and requested a plan. But I do agree with Senator Limmer that semantics are important. And to be honest, I think if whoever drafted this 40 years ago would have called it farm acres instead of green acres, we wouldn't have had quite so much consternation about it all. But I think, you know, if somebody has a better word to use, I'm certainly open to whatever that would be, because we want it to kind of reflect what it's doing.
Sure.
Senator Pogomon.
Senator Scoy, what would be the circumstance where someone would want to do, instead of the CRP, they would want to do this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogomon, I don't think anybody would do this instead of CRP. CRP is a federal program that makes payments for taking land out of production and planting grass on it. One of the things that happened in the changes to the bill last year is I removed those type of activities from eligibility for Green Acres, as, you know, I hate to even use this word, as productive agriculture land in conformity with the classification of agriculture. As we've reviewed this, those parcels of land, in order to qualify for CRP, had to be producing an ag product for 4 of 6 years prior to their going into the CRP. This is an additional property tax benefit to those landowners on top of CRP. And they could be in the Green Acres program. And I think if they met the criteria, they could go into the conservation program. The difference is there is one has the 3-year clawback and the other one has the covenant and the conservation plan.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemon.
As I understood, the previous law was that you could not do both.
Senators, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pogemiller, before the changes I made in 2008, you could do both.
Oh.
And I took that away in the changes, and that was very that was a mistake.
Senator Pogemiller, that's where the pushback really, a lot of the pushback came.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
And that's where the enviros started getting anxious, like myself, because you know the word was that a lot of these acres were going to come out of CRP because the payments weren't enough to make up for, or at least the difference wasn't great enough to make up for the new property tax now. Plus there was the multi-year clawback, and so we had these visions of tractors going right up to the edge of the water and trees being cut down everywhere. So while CRP is a payment, the Green Acres was the tax benefit, and the tax, the higher property tax kicked in that offset the CRP payments.
Senator,
and all this conservation activity was threatened to cease. Some of it, I think, actually did. I don't know how much. I don't know if we have a handle on what has actually happened, but we certainly got wind of a lot of stuff going on.
Senator Pogemon.
So let me just, maybe this is the simplest way. Did the auditor criticize the application of both benefits to the same parcel, to same property?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, my recollection of the auditor's report is they did not.
Okay, so what?
What they criticized, Senator Pogemiller, was the fact there was so much land enrolled that wasn't currently being farmed.
Right, so then why last year did it seem like a good idea to not allow the double?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Pogemiller, my view of that was, and I actually had some little initiative emphasis from the nonprofit debate that we were having at the same time, that a government payment, I didn't view it as ag production. And that's the rationale that I was using. But when I was, went through the thought process of the it had to be ag land prior to qualifying, that it probably, and it currently receives the ag classification, that it should remain as ability to qualify for Green Acres because it is classified as ag land.
See, I'm tracking on all that, and I know, since I don't know the answer to this, I'll probably regret going down this line of thinking, but I can understand why the environmental community would not want to lose Green Acres. I get that. I guess I'm trying to get to the basic question of why should you be able to do both? Is that a good idea?
Senator Dibble?
Well, it's important to remember that not all this property necessarily qualifies. I mean, Green Acres and the attendant, so farm acres, conservation acres, land that we're trying to preserve on a farm, whether it's being tilled or it's next to the property that's being tilled and it's being used for an environmental purpose, not all of it qualifies. It, it has to do with the external pressures that are on those properties for development or other purposes that drive up those values. And so not all these CRP acres are going to qualify, but some, it's just there's no point to enroll in CREP if the benefit is offset by the tax liability.
Senator Squire?
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Senator Pogemiller. The other thing that I think we need to think about with these lands and property taxes is that there is a, you know, a duration of continuity. And CRP is a 10-year commitment generally. And so putting this covenant on or Green Acres on will help maintain continuity as we go forward. As people make decisions about whether to take their land in or out, I mean, because the land can come out of CRP again. And if we were treating it differently than the rest of the agriculture land, then they'd have to do a different assessment when it comes out. And I think Senator Dibble's rationale behind that is that it would be an encouragement for landowners to leave these parcels in CRP, which I think is pretty well accepted as bringing some, you know, certainly some wildlife habitat benefits and other environmental benefits that, you know, people have viewed adding value to the area.
Any other questions, members? On the SCOI motion to adopt the A2 amendment as amended.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lemire.
Mr. Chair, Senator SCOI, have you vetted this language with any of the concerned groups that came raising questions, or have they had any opportunity to look at it?
Senator SCOI.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lemire, I have been in discussions with a large number of the groups that have had concerns. I haven't actually had an opportunity to have this exact language, but I have had language that is very close. I have talked to them about the changes that we were making here. We've kind of run this around through the department once quickly. I don't think I've heard of anybody who doesn't like the changes that have been proposed, but that doesn't mean they're not out there. But of the folks I've talked to, they've all been pretty supportive of the effort.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Lemire,
were you planning on this wasn't going to be a standalone thing. This was an amendment onto the tax bill for later this year. So there'll be plenty of opportunity for the public to get involved if they see fit.
Senator Lemire, this is going on the federal conformity bill that I expect is going to be on the Senate floor next week.
I see. All right.
There, Senator SCOI.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Lemire, there is some reason for moving this quicker rather than later. A number of the farm organizations were really concerned when my initial emphasis was to just work through the session on this and include it in the omnibus bill. They were concerned of people making decisions without knowing what the parameters of those decisions were. And to be honest, that's one of the reasons not to just do an extension and let this thing hang out there, because then people are going to make decisions without knowing what the parameters are. I think we have a pretty good fix to what we did last year. I think that it has been pretty well accepted by those folks. We do still have some time to, you know, it's not going to go into law tomorrow, but I think it is going to move faster rather than slower.
Mr. Chair, I remember Senator Koch brought this issue up on the Senate floor to correct quickly the Green Acre issue. And if I remember right, she just wanted to restore the language from the previous year and just leave it at that. And this has a little bit more parameter or definition. Is that Chamber would that be correct?
Senator SCOI.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lemire. Well, one of the reasons to not just to go back to the Green Acres program is all the problems that existed with that would still be in place. Mm-hmm. I think we've addressed a large number of those. The worst one is that we had these parcels of land that aren't kind of traditional agriculture. They have value, but they aren't traditional agriculture. And there was no mechanism for putting a uniform value on them. And you know, when you look across the state from your neck of the woods to mine, you can see the problem there. And we have found a way to address that now. And I actually think the policy of it's pretty sound.
Is that the new word for non-productive? traditional agriculture?
Well, I tell you, I've really been struggling because I know it's important that you use the right terminology.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Senator Skoy. He's done a lot of good thinking, a lot of hard work. He dragged me along on a couple of conversations. I was able to participate. And I also checked out conceptually some of these ideas with some of the environmental groups who think these sound like good ideas. I haven't been able to share specific language, but I'm suspecting that they'll be really pleased with this product. Probably, you know, we need to probably nudge it around a little bit. We don't always have the best ideas inside our own heads, but so it's some good work, and I think lots of the diverse stakeholders are becoming a lot more comfortable with this proposal.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate all the work that Senator Skoy has done on this bill. It's a complicated issue, to be sure. I'm troubled, however, by the process of this. We're talking about an amendment to a bill that's on a fast track to the floor, and there's been no public hearing. And we have a public safety, or excuse me, public safety, a property tax subcommittee that could hear this bill. I understand that we probably could continue to change this. We could turn it into law now, and we could maybe bring it up in hearings later. But I think we've missed the point, which is, and Senator Skoy made it on the Senate floor, we need to have public participation in this change. There are a lot of people that will be affected by what we're proposing today, and we didn't even put it on for the hearing calendar for today. It's an amendment. And I'm troubled by that. People do want to participate, and they do care about this issue. I hear about it every single day from people in my district, and I'm not sure we've considered all of the interests. There may be many interest groups that are comfortable with this. We may not be hearing. We don't even allow ourselves to hear any opposition because the process is set up not to. And I think that destroys the public confidence in what we do in the Senate Tax Committee and in the Senate as a whole. And I think it's unfortunate that we're heading in this direction.
Senator Ortman, there's been a lot of discussion, public discussion, on this Green Acres issue this session, both in the Ag Committee in the House and the Senate, and the Environment Committee in the Senate. There's been a great deal of discussion about how to deal with these non-traditional agriculture acres, or whatever name we're going to give them. It's not fair to say that this hasn't had a lot of public discussion. Senator Ortman.
Well, Mr. Chair, we normally have hearings on bills. This proposal was not in the public record. No one knew this was coming up. I think this is a consolidation of many ideas. It's almost essentially an omnibus bill on some of these issues. We owe it to the public to have a conversation about this proposal and all the different things that feed into it and all of the impacts. There may be unintended consequences that we're not aware of that we should hear about before we rush to make new law. And so I'm troubled by it. You have the votes to pass whatever you want in this committee, Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, but I just want you to know that I'm concerned about it. It's 12 pages, it's complicated, and we have not put it out into the public for review and comment.
Senator Skoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, the Green Acres, I think we've had lots of discussion in this committee and other discussion committees on. The conservation part, took from Senator Metzen's bill. And it's in this committee. It's been through ag, and it's been through environment. And much of what is in this bill, I came to the table and helped discussed Senator Metzen's bill with him at the environment committee. We talked about much of these very things. We talked about having a plan in place. We talked about the mechanism for the covenant. There was I don't know what the length of time in the environment committee was, but I was in that committee for at least 2 hours, and we had a pretty fair amount of time given to this in the Ag Committee, certainly an hour. So I don't think that's a fair criticism. Both of those bills are in this committee's jurisdiction right now.
Well, Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, there are a lot of people that are watching the Tax Committee to see bills like this, and it's not on our agenda.
Any other discussion, members? Senator Sandra.
Mr. Chair, and just certainly share Senator Ortman's concerns, knowing what the path is on this, but with respect to the floor, is this going to project it'll be on the agenda on Monday, or do we have at least a week? Because a week would give us some time to, you know, to vet this out to our folks back home, so to speak, and get some input. Do you have any idea when this is going to be on the floor?
Senator Pogemiller probably has a better idea than I do, but this committee report will go up to the floor today. And beyond that, it's kind of out of control.
Mr. Chair, obviously, you know, it'd be helpful if we had at least till next Thursday. If this is on Monday, it's going to make it really difficult to, you know, to get any feedback.
I mean, I don't have a problem suggesting that to leadership.
Okay.
Any other discussion, members, on the A2 amendment as amended? Not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Skoy moves House File 392 as amended. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Sent to the floor. Anything else, members? We are going to meet Tuesday next week. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday next week. Anything else? This committee's adjourned.